For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Friday, an enormous victory for the UAW, an enormous victory for the workers at the Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, an enormous victory for working people across the country, for people in Tennessee, for people in the South. This could be that spark, that moment that everything ignites and workers go, yeah, we are essential. Yeah, you need us as much as we need you. Yeah, we should have better wages, better hours, better conditions, better health care, better retirement, better treatment. We should have those things. And you know what? We're going to demand them because we have a way forward to do that. And I understand, for decades, you have seen the shifting, the migration of manufacturing from northern states, from union states, from high-wage states to the South, and then the further South, and then the further South, and then way East. You've been seeing corporate America and corporate global going, hey, where can we get cheap exploitable labor? Where can we go to find that cheap labor? And unfortunately, here in the U.S., that has been in the South. This could be that moment where the workers in the South go, you know what, we're tired of being the country's doormat. We're tired of getting the short end of the stick. We're tired of getting poor treatment, high turnover, poor wages, you know, less benefits, less health care, all of that. We're tired of it. And we're going to fight to make it better. This could be that spark. And you go back through history when you've had those moments. You know, you go back to 1894 when the Pullman strike happened, which led to the fight for just general dignity for minority workers and ethnic workers who lived in a company town. And when you had an economic downturn, George Pullman, the company town owner, you know, skyrocketed rents, cut wages, basically starving his workforce so that he could maintain, you know, a good, healthy profit margin. And also just basic, like I said, basic dignity. You know, the 10,000 people who were the car porters, they were all called George. Now, who knows what their real names were, but they were the 10,000 Georges. You don't even have the dignity of your own name in Pullman world. You go back to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, another moment in our history where you go, hey, this tragedy happened. This thing happened. 146 workers died, mostly women, young women, immigrants. led to incredible safety, workplace safety regulations, better labor laws, started moving us in the direction that we now take for granted. I had, you know, a listener, you know, say this could be like the Flint sit-down strike of the 30s. In 36, 37, you had these sit-down strikes, which was a pivotal moment in labor history, which led to the improvement of working conditions, and more importantly, union recognition, and then collective bargaining rights in the auto industry. And I've had that thought, you know, could this be that spark moment? Could this be that spark moment where you begin to then organize one after the other, until eventually you get to a place where you now represent all of them? And you then bring them into a master agreement to where you say, look, compete. All you car companies, go make the best widgets and whatnots. Use the labor as efficiently as you can. Do what you can. But you're not going to make your competitive advantage on the backs of the workers. You're not going to say, hey, we cut wages down to the bone so we could give you $50 off your car. That to me is where this line should be drawn. And I've been saying this for a long time. Now, understand, I come out of an industry that had at one point had a master agreement. You know, when I was in the, you know, I'm in the LTL, less than truckload trucking industry, where, you know, when I started, it was 85% unionized. It's now down to about 10% because of the all-out assault on organized labor over the last 40 years. But it was almost 100% unionized. I mean, and those companies, they competed based on service, on quality, on all of the positives, instead of we're gonna cheat our workers out of healthcare. We're gonna destroy their pensions. We're gonna cut their wages. We're gonna make them work longer hours, and of course, no overtime. Now, these are moments where we're a possibility. You could go back again through history, the March on Washington in 63, which led to the Civil Rights Act, when workers find their power. And this, from what I'm hearing, workers in Chattanooga, they're finding their power. When you have a vote, 73-27, when you have a massive victory like this, in a place that has turned down the union in the past, when you have this decisive of a victory, could lead to that spark of something new. History could look back and go, there it was. That was the moment. And you stop and you think about, again, throughout our history, there have been these sparks, these opportunities for people to go, we're going to exert our power. We're going to demand democracy in the workplace. We're going to demand economic freedom and economic justice. We're going to demand these things. Because one, it's right. It's just. It's all that. But it's what the workers earn. You know, I had said a while ago that I thought the Fight for 15 campaign, you know, was a great moment in our labor history. Because it really did begin a conversation on national income inequality. It really did bring that to the forefront and some major victories. But you know, my problem is I've never been a fan of, hey, how do we just raise up the bottom? Because I know there's a reverberation effect upward. I'm of the mindset that every workplace should have a collective bargaining agreement. For me, this is an opportunity to highlight the fact that you can make lives better. And what these workers are going to demand will be interesting to see over the next several months as they negotiate a contract. And I got to think that they're going to negotiate in good faith, considering, and this is the other weird thing, that in Germany, they actually have a law that says, you know, you can't break the unions. You can't bash the union. Sorry, that's bad. We're not going to let you go after the unions and attack them, you know, like you're allowed to do in the U.S. We're just never going to allow you to do that. And again, I find it interesting that, you know, in this country, we're like, no, go ahead. Go ahead. You know, go. And it's almost like you have to. But in Germany, they've got this German act on corporate due diligence obligations in supply chains. It's a nice long, you know, in German, it's very small, but in English, a little bit longer. The UAW actually filed charges against Mercedes-Benz Group for violating that law beginning of April because of Mercedes-Benz's aggressive anti-union campaign. And I got to tell you, wouldn't it be great if we had labor legislation in this country that supported workers? Man, I wish. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, it's always amazing to me when you see politicians who are running on the idea that, you know, come on down to our area and exploit our workers. This is something, you know, the South has been doing for a very long time. And it's always blown my mind when Southern politicians run those campaigns and go, yeah, please exploit my voters. And then people vote for them. And the reason I'm saying this is I'm looking at an article over the New York Times where they quote Gerald McCormick, who had been the majority leader in the Tennessee House, a Republican House, who said, you know, if we become less competitive, why not just do it in Detroit? And this has been their argument. We're cheaper. Come exploit our workforce. Pay them less wages, less benefits. Give them worse working conditions. And employers will come. And sadly, a lot did. So I look at this victory by the UAW at the VW plant. This is a steal of Bidenism. It's a big freaking deal. And here to share some thoughts on just what a big freaking deal this is, I've asked our good friend John Russell to come talk with us. He's the owner, editor of the Holler newsletter. He also does some reporting over at More Perfect Union. His recent video on this Volkswagen campaign, over 2.5 million views in just a couple of days. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you for having me on, Rick. Yeah, this is a really big deal. Looking forward to talking about it.
So, I mean, you know, I knew they were going to win. I had it in my gut that, you know, all the stars are aligning. I had it in my head that, you know, you're coming off the last close one, the pandemic, the win with the big three, the stars were aligning. I just didn't predict a 73-26. I didn't predict that at all.
Yeah, there's a no doubt about it win. And I think, you know, there's a reason for why that margin was so huge in favor of union. Yes. People are tired of being squeezed by this economy, and not just in Detroit, in the South. You know, workers have seen what's possible everywhere else, what's possible with this new leadership at the UAW. They saw big contracts that were won up in Detroit, and they said, give us a slice of that pie. And they got it for themselves. You know, it's a long time in the making, 10 years, couple failed votes. It was really, really powerful to be down there and witnessing people bringing in their union.
I had one person email me and say the difference that they believed was because the UAW was different. You know, that there was a view of the old UAW as a little, you know, a little lazy, a little, maybe a little corrupt, if you will. And this one very much, very militant, very member driven, very active. And that was the belief. Do you put any stock in that?
Yeah, you know, I think ultimately you got to judge a union by how much power they give their members. The UAW has been, you know, these are democratically governed institutions, you know, but not always, right? So they've been turning more power to their members. That membership has led to some reforms like one member, one vote, more democracy in the union. You know, it wasn't that long ago when you had leaders of that union that pulled off a corruption scandal, ended up in jail. We got to remember when we're looking at Sean Fain and the new leadership of this union, he was only elected 14 months ago. And a lot, as we've seen, can happen in 14 months. And I think, you know, the main thing to credit there is just trusting your membership, turning power towards your membership with any democracy, right? It's going to be better when that power is in the hands of the people. Yeah. UAW had those reforms and we were seeing wins from it.
And I would also argue, you know, using some resources. I know there are a lot of unions that go, oh, we're constantly under attack. We got to keep the powder dry. This is a very active union. They're spending a lot of resources. In fact, you know, I think they said, what was it, $30 million they're going to spend over the next decade to try and organize, which, you know, is a pretty good sum.
Oh, for sure. They're putting money into organizing, like you said. And I think that these wins that they're on, you know, first with the big three and those incredible contracts that a lot of people were taking inspiration from. Now with a win that nobody, you know, not a lot of people thought was possible. We're waking up to news that, you know, after 40 years, there's a union automaker now in the South. This is a testament to they made a big bet on political courage. They, you know, nobody would have blamed a leader like Sean Fain, you know, coming into the power after membership was hanging out near a record low, after a recent scandal, after a close election. If they wanted to play it safe, everybody would have, you know, understood that. But they took a big bet on political courage, on fighting for, you know, real wins to membership. And the members, you know, from my reporting experience, are looking around, seeing that things are possible, and they're winning unions in the South because of it.
And this is something I wish, you know, not to get political here, but this is something I wish the Democratic Party would figure out. You win by doing bold things. You win by getting out there and balling up your digits and getting in the fight. But, you know, you were on the ground for the last little over a week, I guess. And what was the message that you heard most often from folks? Was it about wages? Was it about conditions? Was it about dignity? Where did the hammer come down?
Yeah. And first of all, the reporting trip, I want to shout out More Perfect Union for doing their reporter and for doing that story. And my producer, Katie Nixdorf, she was really good in putting that video together. But the thing that stuck with me is and what we heard from folks on the ground there, this is about more than just money and benefits. This was about the chance to stay in one workplace, to not constantly cycle through jobs, to make the place where you are better because you have power, you have a voice at the table, you have a say in how your company is governed. And because of that, you have a say in your local economy, how your community is. A lot of members told us, you know, one guy, he's a father, he works with his son in the plant. He's telling his son to like dig in. You want this to be the last job you're gonna have and you wanna stay here and make it better. And then having that union representation, that's what it was really about to a lot of the people that we spoke with.
Now, the first election there at Volkswagen was back in 2014. How many of the people who lived through that experience in 2014 were part of this experience here a decade later? Or do you have any idea?
I don't have an idea on hard numbers there, but we did talk to several, and I can say the most powerful reactions came from them. You know, there were a couple people we talked to that were there for 12 years, you know, and they've been through multiple votes where they've come close and come up short, including ones where they thought they had it in the bag. You know, to see the reaction from them of finally prevailing, what else can you say? It's something that I won't forget for a long time. But, you know, the plant had a lot of turnover, right? And it was a different group of people who were going through this election, right? A lot of new blood came into that plant and they are looking around and say, you know, what do we have to lose here? Let's get together. We've heard, you know, anti-union arguments in the past. here they come trotting out the same old thing. And a lot of folks just didn't believe the arguments of the anti-union campaign anymore because they've heard it in the past. And then they went through COVID and saw how workers labeled essential were really treated. And they came out on the other side of that and said, there's nothing but room to run in front of us. Let's take a chance on the union. And they were helped out by a lot of the people who had stuck around for, you know, 12 years and watched the failures in the past.
Now, what was the most interesting story that you got from someone? I'm sure there were some responses there that were, you know, from the baseline to some pretty far out there. Anything far out there?
I think the most powerful thing is just so much of the resistance to unions, especially in the South, is just based on a fear campaign. And what it really looked like when we were talking to workers down there, people just realize that it's a paper tiger that they're afraid of. You know, there's a boy who cried wolf effect happening here because, like I said, all of these anti-union arguments have been trotted out before. Oh, they're going to close the plant. They're going to move it to Mexico or something like this. Well, no, you know, they would have built it there to begin with if that was the best business decision. Our wages have always been higher, but they chose to build the plant here. They're investing money in that plant. It's around to stay. So why don't the workers have a seat at the table, right? The biggest takeaway wasn't an individual story. It was everybody down there kind of realizing that all of the arguments against a union are just based on fear. Yeah. And they chose to reject that and win their union.
And I would argue, and maybe this is something that came up, but being the only place in the system that doesn't have representation, yeah. You know, that kind of leaves the, I guess that would leave a bad taste in my mouth, but you know, did that come up at all?
Yeah, for sure. And that comes up not just with workers at the plant, but members of the community, faith leaders. We talked to, you know, a pastor in the community who brought that up on her own and said, this is the only plant in the world without worker representation. This is, you know, a German company. Their culture over there has works councils and a principle of co-determination. That's something that we don't really internalize here, but that means that, you know, from management to employee, everybody has an equal base that they're coming to, at least in, you know, on paper, in the governance of the company, right? And here is the United States plant as the only one where that principle doesn't apply. So, you know, Volkswagen workers knew that. But even members out in the community were starting to really talk about that. And, you know, when you sit back and think about it, you have to wonder why that is. I think it's powerful.
No, and that it is powerful because, you know, for me, looking at this, such an overwhelming victory means a couple of things. One, workers seriously wanted it. But two, the organizers on the ground were able to get over some hurdles. You know, in the South, you've got we just hate anything from the North. That's part of it. You've got the race issue. I'm sure you've got legacy issues. There's a lot of stuff there to get past. And I think, well, apparently the organizers got around it.
I would take it, you know, my sense was not to take away from anything that the organizers do. I mean, their job is really, really hard. They work very hard for this. But this was a member win. And you could really see that coming through in the people we interviewed. We interviewed, you know, white male Republicans, black women who were, you know, Democrats, people all across the spectrum, right? And they really carried the messaging member to member. And what, you know, one of them was telling me, it's like, we didn't have to go and convince these no voters to change their mind. They watched the anti-union campaigns. They watched those six governors come out and say that this would be against our very way of life. And it started to ring, you know, they started to say, hey, whose side are you really on here? And these members, they're all watching, you know, the union's bet on political courage pay off when people are winning big contracts at the big three. And so one of the members who was always in the yes camp was like, in these no votes, it's like the yes argument was in them all along. And all we had to do was point out, hey, this is a different era. This is a different union. We are putting up wins here, and the time's now to get our slice of the pie in the South.
So you think the six governors coming out this time had a negative impact, because look, this isn't new. You had politicians back, you know, the senators and the governors back in 14 doing almost the same thing, only I would argue with a lot more pressure. So this time you think it went the other way?
I think so. And, you know, in my mind, it might have been the case. Volkswagen in the past has used this tactic and kind of let the anti-union politicians speak their piece. And in one of the previously failed votes, they brought back a very popular manager, and they made all of these promises, and it lined up with what the politicians were saying. And lo and behold, the vote happens, they reject the union, and all of those promises and all that stuff, that it went away.
Yeah.
And people were back to the status quo, just being squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. So when they saw that happen this time again, it was the boy who cried wolf thing. Yeah. They've seen this and they recognized it for what it is.
Yeah, we saw this movie. What do you say to some of the reporting that I've seen that are diminishing this victory as well? This is the German company. They're clearly going to do, you know, Volkswagen, Mercedes first, because they're a German company. Germany's got a law that, you know, could fine them or have some penalties if they, hinder worker organizing. What do you say to that?
I mean, those are PR talking points that you do when you're on the run. You know, when you're being defensive, that's what you trot out to try and minimize what's going on. And that's exactly what it is. It's minimizing a huge movement. I mean, there's the phrase "when pigs fly," but it might as well be when, you know, union automakers are popping up in the South, right? This is a massive, massive turning point in the labor movement that I think, people have been questioning. Are we at a new moment in the labor movement? And they've been looking for evidence of that. There's been a lot of reporting throwing cold water on the fact that we might be in a new labor movement. But I think this gets rid of all of those arguments. There is a union automaker in the South, won by members, hard fought, multiple failed votes over 10 years. And there's just no denying the significance of that.
No.
And I think we'll keep watching it as other union automakers like Mercedes have their votes in a couple weeks.
No, it's a big deal, because when one falls, maybe the rest come along, because not just them, but the parts suppliers and all the businesses that feed into this, much like we saw in the 30s. I mean, this could be that spark that reignites that reward for work. When you got to open the books and see what your labor is worth, you start going, "I'd like more of it, please." So last line of questioning I've got for you, May is coming up fairly quick. You've got the Mercedes vote. Are we expecting a victory like this size? Have you talked to any people in Alabama? What are the thoughts so far?
I'd never want to get into predictions about that, but all I can say from, talking to members, you had union workers from Detroit after their big wins coming down and talking with workers down in Chattanooga, encouraging them, saying like, if we did it up here, you can do it down here. The same thing's happening. Volkswagen workers in Chattanooga are looking to Mercedes and saying, hey, if we did it here, you can do it there. And they've been tirelessly organizing. I think the UAW has a really good strategy with the stand-up strikes that we're seeing. They're smart about how they use their resources. And I'm excited to see what happens in these other plants. And, any time that workers are talking to each other and spreading inspiration that way, I think it's a good thing. So we'll see where it goes.
I'm right there with you. And look, I would love to see a master contract at some point in my lifetime where all auto workers are making the same wages, hours, conditions, so that, it's who makes the best widget and not who's working for the cheapest wages.
Yep. Speak it into existence.
There you go. John, I appreciate the time. Excellent reporting over at More Perfect Union. I hope folks will take a look at it. We'll get links out so people can take a look at the video that's gotten over 2.5 million views so far. But John Russell, thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
John Russell, owner and editor of The Holler Newsletter. Make sure you check out the work that they do at theholler.co. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. I want to hear your thoughts. Quick break. Right back.
C Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So when you look at the numbers, 73% of Volkswagen workers recently voted to be represented by the UAW. And look, everybody ecstatic. The news, lots of news, lots of big news. Every outlet pointing out how historic this is. Now, you go back 10 years, the first time they had an election there at Volkswagen, it was voted down. Here we are 10 years later, massive, enormous victory. And here to share some thoughts on, well, is this really a big deal? Historically speaking, is this really a big deal? That's why I've asked Eric Loomis to come talk with us. He's a professor, historian, blogger at Lawyers, Guns, and Money, and author of the most important book on work, History of America in 10 Strikes. Eric, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So let's get to that big question. Is this a big deal?
Yes, 100%. Huge deal. I mean, the UAW had been trying for so long to organize in the South, and it mostly failed. And this really replicates a much broader problem in the labor movement, which is that the South has been a major issue in organizing for a century. You know, going all the way back to the 1890s, Southern politicians were willing to repeal labor laws, use the police, the National Guard to kill union organizers, you know, have lower wages, all kinds of things. And it's been really hard to organize the South. And while it's only one election, I think that there's little question that this is the beginning of a wave where you're going to see a lot of organizing in the South. And I think that the key is this 73% approval rating. That's huge, right? This is not a 52-48 win. This is an overwhelming victory for a union in a factory that has been targeted for a long, long time. And workers have finally said, enough, we want our union. And they stood up to the intimidation that these right-wing politicians in the South were pushing on them and voted their conscience and voted in their interest to form a union. So yeah, it's pretty freaking big.
Yeah. In your opinion, how much of this is, you know, coming out of the pandemic, you know, that whole essential worker, you know, frontline hero thing, and how much of it was the fact that the big three, the UAW got a really good contract out of the big three over this last strike? How much do you think, or is it both?
Well, it's a lot of things. I mean, I think it's both of those things. I think the pandemic certainly has played a major role in people rethinking their relationship to work and what they want on the job. We've seen this in the working classes all the way up into, like, you know, corporate offices, that a lot of people have sort of rethought this, and that has contributed significantly to this. The UAW big victory against the Big Three is huge. Absolutely. I mean, you know, as soon as the UAW wins, all of those Southern Auto plants, they give their workers big raises. And it's like, huh, I wonder why we got that big raise. Oh, maybe it's because the union was, you know, made this happen. Right. And so, you know, the momentum is very clearly here. I think that there are other factors as well. One of them certainly, I think, is the Biden administration and its general pro-labor pro-labor positions and the ways in which it has used the National Labor Relations Board to try and get in the way of the kind of corporate intimidation that has been so common against unions. And then also on top of it, the South is changing. I mean, the workforce itself in that Chattanooga plant is a lot different than it was 10 years ago. A lot of people have moved from the North to the South, and they're bringing, you know, more pro-union ideas with them. Immigration to the South has made a big difference. And so also the South is changing. So there's just a lot going on here.
Yeah, but, you know, you brought up the NLRB, and this was a fairly quick election from the time that they signed cards, you know, petitioned for the election to it actually happening, because we know a lot of the plan from the Union Buster playbook is draw these things out, have a lot of captive audience meetings, do a lot of harassment, intimidation, some firings spattered in. This seemed fairly quick.
Yeah, I mean, some of that is definitely the NLRB. I think that some of it is probably the way that German companies operate. You know, in Germany, unions are on the board, you know, the governing boards of these corporations. And so, like, you know, Volkswagen worker unions in Germany, they have a voice in production decisions and things like this that would be, you know, almost impossible to think of in the U.S. And so, you know, certainly they're getting pressure from their German unions to not be the kind of hardcore union busters that perhaps they could be. And I think that's a reason that you're seeing, first with this Volkswagen plan and then this upcoming election next month with the Mercedes plan in Alabama, that you are seeing the UAW target the German auto companies first to kind of like build that wave and then go on to the Japanese companies, which are probably more likely to engage in some of this more aggressive union busting behavior.
I want to go back to something you said about, you know, the laws in the South and how they've used, you know, a lot of these tactics, you know, as you point out, you know, the National Guard, state police, you know, convict labor lease programs that, you know, even using, you know, black workers to break white worker strikes, all of this, every way you could use the divisions of this country to destroy the working class, they have done. I look at the fact that you had six governors coming out and, you know, signing onto a letter saying, if you do this, bad things are going to happen. It seems like the more things change, the more, well, they try to stay the same.
Oh, no question. The Southern elite class has been pretty terrible for union issues going back to the Civil War before. You know, that these are states that have been extraordinarily conservative on racial issues, of course, but also on economic issues really forever. And so, yeah, not much has changed. I think that, you know, what we're kind of seeing right now is these governors running scared. You know, that letter, which was so pathetic, you know, this basically attempt to intimidate workers without really anything behind it, it was a sad state of affairs in some ways, because I think that they fear that there's this so-called economic advantage that they think that they have by being able to attract low-wage labor to their states. It doesn't make a lot of sense anymore. In part because these are states with rising living standards. I mean, the economic separation between Southern and Northern states continues to decline and has for a long, long time. And, you know, it's this weird conundrum that they're facing where they're, you know, bragging about all these Northerners that are moving south and talking about, you know, oh, leaving these liberal states or whatever. But a lot of these people are going there and bringing liberal ideas with them, right? And so they want some parts of this change, but they don't want other parts of this change, but they've lost control of it. And I think that this is a part of a broader changing South that you're seeing. I mean, these are still conservative states, and we see this in many, many ways. But on some of these economic issues, I think you're going to be very likely to see a lot more union organizing in these states.
Now, you know, it's interesting to me. You're seeing a lot of states, you know, Georgia being one of them, who are moving towards, if you don't force a union election, if you don't, you know, put up a campaign against the unions, we're not going to give you any tax money. It seems like, you know, again, they're trying to use the power of the purse and the power of government to tilt the scale, which it's always been my view, especially with conservatives, that you want government out of the equation. You know, this should truly be about workers and employers coming together and figuring out how they're going to move forward without government intervention.
Yeah, well, this talk about the free market and everything from right-wing politicians has been a lie forever. They are more than happy to use the power of the government to tilt the scale in favor of corporations, and they always have been, right? So, you know, this has always been a lie. They never have believed in the free market. That's always been an excuse to use the government to back up employers. And these threats against corporations, that's pretty pathetic, right? That is from, I mean, they're actually trying to intimidate corporations from recognizing their own unions, which is, I think, a new strategy, right? Because most of the time, corporations don't want unions. And I think that this is a recognition that's for some companies, and this has always been an argument unions have made effectively, that having a union in your plant will actually make the company run better. It'll be more efficient, more effective, because people will be on board with one another, you know, trying to create a successful operation as opposed to always at each other's throats.
Yep.
And if companies agreed to that, like, American workplaces would be better and more efficient and everything else. And so this is pretty sad stuff from these Southern governors.
I worked for a company for years that, you know, their salespeople used to go, and one of their sales pitches is they had the lowest turnover rate in the industry. You know, less than 1% workforce turnover per year, which, you know, any trucking company in the country would drool over. And it's because they paid good wages. Workers had a say in how things were done. They had good benefits, safe conditions, all of that stuff. And people wanted to stay.
Yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. You know, and I wish more companies would realize this. But, you know, and I think that a few are, right? I think there's this fear that these Southern companies, you know, foreign companies are going to just come to some kind of agreement rather than go through this process. And I don't know if that's true or not, but it's pretty clear that these right-wing politicians in the South are truly frightened about unions, which is hilarious, because if there's one thing that's going to make the South a better place to live, it's more unions. But they don't want the South to be a better place.
Yeah, well,
to live, right?
You know,
they want the exploitation, because that's what they build on to create their little, you know, their little power structures.
No, it's the reason these companies moved there. I mean, you know, that's the reality. That's what they sold. You can exploit our people. And now the people are saying, we don't want to be exploited anymore.
Yeah, there's a famous case in 1892. Alabama had just passed a child labor law that banned child labor. And there was a company, a textile company in Massachusetts, that had just had to deal with the union. And they hated it. So they go to Alabama and they say, hey, we will move our factory down to your state if you repeal that child labor law, because we want to employ your children. And the state of Alabama said, okay. And that's what they did. And the company closed. They moved to Alabama. And that set up a whole century of this mobility. I mean, you know, to talk about this historical significance a little bit more, you know, the CIO and the AFL too, really realized that, you know, as they were organizing in Flint and Chicago and all Ohio and all these other places in the 30s, that a lot of these companies could close and move to the South. And so after World War II, the CIO engages in what's called Operation Dixie, which was a widespread attempt to organize the South. And the point here was not only to organize the South, but to take away those incentives to close those factories and move down there. And it fails. It fails for a number of reasons, a lot of which are about race. And we can get into that if you want to, but the broader point is, in its failure, what the CIO feared was true, which was that companies did close union factories, move them to the South, eventually move them overseas, and you create the situation that we have today, where unions, especially in the private sector, have so often struggled to survive. And this new victory potentially is a transformational moment. And maybe you're going to start seeing a much broader unionization effort in places like Tennessee and Alabama.
Now, these are right-to-work states. And, you know, I had someone email me and go, well, it doesn't matter. You know, you're still going to have this large contingent of people who don't want it. So you're going to have that division in the workplace. Do you see that as a problem?
Well, it is what it is. I mean, you know, it's not ideal, no. But I think that, you know, I mean, thinking about the public sector, for instance, you know, with the Janus decision, the Supreme Court basically ruled that for public sector unions, it's right to work everywhere. And, you know, in my own union, in a union of faculty, professors is not the most, you know, it's not perhaps the most relevant example. But, you know, because we did not, you know, we had all these people who had to pay into the union anyway, we had not done a very good job of organizing them. And, you know, we were down to maybe 55% of members being of employees being in the union. And now, because, you know, we needed their money, I mean, we needed their contributions and we need them to join the union to be active, we've moved that up to about 75%, which is pretty good. And so in some ways, what right to work does, and I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it does force the union to continue to be active, organizing internally to get members to be members, right? To get workers to be members and then participate in the union. And so it's not great. Obviously, it'd be much better if there's not right to work. But I think what you're going to see is a union with every incentive to be democratic, to really engage members on the ground. And sure, some people aren't going to join. Well, what are you going to do about that? Sure. But you're going to see, as you saw, 73% of people, you know, voting yes, and probably more than that will join because I'm sure intimidation affected some of this. You're going to see a pretty activist union that is still going to make a pretty big difference on the ground. And so, yeah, it's a complicated scenario, but there are ways around it, as my own union has discussed.
No, where I wanted to go with this, and you alluded to it. You know, when we were in Iowa, I met a bunch of folks who were on strike when we were there in 2022. And, you know, what they explained is, you know, when Iowa went and became a right to work state, what you saw is, you know, people grabbing onto their union tighter and people becoming much more militant. So, you know, could this, you know, one factory, you know, in Tennessee, could this be that beginning of labor militancy in a place where you've had a lot of attempt to crush it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think we're going to see quite a bit of that. I mean, I'm very, very confident in that Alabama factory, the Mercedes plant, is going to vote yes. And I think that this is kind of a symbol. I mean, in some ways, the real significance of this victory is not the number of workers. I mean, you know, it's a good size factory, but it's not enough to turn around the entire American labor movement or something like that.
No, but it's a big deal.
It is.
No, I mean, when was the last time a plant of this size, an employer of this size, was organized?
Yeah, I don't know. It's, I mean, in the South especially, I the 40s, 50s, I mean, it's been a long, long time. But I think that the bigger significance actually is that what it says is that the South is now open for unions, right? That now all kinds of unions can go and invest in the South and feel like they're going to win those campaigns. And that's what could potentially change everything, is all kinds of unions now going down to the South, organizing these workplaces. And that's what you see really begin to rebuild the American labor movement. So this is a moment, I think, of tremendous optimism. And that optimism is justified. And I want to say, I am not a person who tends to be over optimistic about things.
No, I won't say that about you.
This is a good day.
No, I won't say that about you or myself, to be honest. But I look at this as a great opportunity. Now, a moment ago, you said that, you know, race, you know, has been something that's been used in the past. I fully expect that to be something used here in the future. You know, can you talk a little bit about what we've seen in the past, and how maybe we can watch out for the future?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a big part of the reason why Operation Dixie failed was that the union movement was seen as pro-civil rights. You know, a lot of the organizers were also Jewish. There was a lot of anti-Semitism. And these companies had chosen these very particular places in the South to move. They were really smart about it. So they didn't move to areas with, say, a large Black population. They moved to mostly white areas with very high concentrations of evangelical religion, where there were no immigrants. I mean, it was a world in which they moved to that was a very isolated world. And the unions seemed like not only outsiders in terms of the economic side of things, which maybe the workers would be interested in, but in terms of race, in terms of religion and ethnicity. The South has changed so much, right? We're a long ways from 1925 anymore, or even from the 1970s. You know, look at a state like Georgia, where you have seen, you know, people pour into the Atlanta area and shift the politics of that state. a city like Charlotte has become a major destination for young Black professionals. Not every Southern state has been transformed in this way, but you certainly are seeing in these big migrations back to the South, people bringing different politics in. And so in certain areas, absolutely race is going to be a powerful way to divide the union. But it's the South is not the same as it was 50 years ago or 100 years ago. And so I think that's part of what's happening here. You know, a city like Chattanooga has had pretty significant demographic transformations. Different ideas have come in to this city. And lo and behold, you're seeing unions be able to win.
Yeah, I had someone email me last night and they said, you know, this is bigger than what happened in Flint during the 30s. And I'm going, I don't know about that, but it's a big deal.
Yeah, let's not overstate it. This is a big win. I think that we have to not put pressure, I think, on every time the labor movement wins something. I mean, we saw this with the Amazon union win, where all of a sudden now, you know, Chris Smalls, the head of this union, became like this giant labor celebrity. And lo and behold, they stopped actually organizing Amazon plants and the whole thing blew up. And I think a lot of that came from the entire world of labor being like, yes, we won. Yes, you're the future. And it's like, well, let's actually let this play out.
Yeah.
Let's see workers continue to organize. Let's let them build the organization on the ground before we, a bunch of outsiders, come in and say, you're the future. So this is a big day, but let's not overstate the importance of it. If this becomes a trend and you see widespread organizing in the South and auto organizers across the country, then yes, this will be a historically important moment. And historians will talk about this as a major transformational moment in American labor history. But let's give that a few years.
Well, let's give that until they get a contract. So last question I've got for you, because obviously, yeah, this is a big victory. But, you know, the hard work is now. Are you going to get that first contract? Because we know in many cases that doesn't happen. What do you think that's going to look like?
I think that in this case, Volkswagen's probably going to sit down and negotiate again, in part because of the influence of the German unions in Germany, that they're going to put pressure on Volkswagen board to sit down and do this. I think when we get to the Japanese factories, that might very well be a much harder fight. I certainly think that a lot of employers right now are desperately hoping that Donald Trump wins this fall so that a new National Labor Relations Board will come in that will do whatever companies want. So I do think, you know, like we're seeing with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette struggle, where you see the NLRB now cracking down on the newspaper's anti-labor practices, you know, they're desperately hoping that Trump takes over so they can return to those practices. So there could be attempts to delay until after the election to see what happens. But I do think that in this case, in these German cases, you were more likely to see an honest negotiation up front, especially given the overwhelming victory of the union, than you would in a different time and place or with a smaller union margin.
Well, it's going to be exciting to see that. Like you said, this is a big deal. I'm excited about what comes next, and I'm sure you'll be back to tell us what the next victory means. Eric, as always, appreciate the time. Great talking with you.
Hey, thank you so much.
Our good friend Eric Loomis, professor, historian, lawyers, guns and money blogger, and your must read, A History of America in 10 Strikes, written by Eric Loomis. Want to hear your thoughts. We blowing this out of proportion? Is this really, do you think, a big deal? Could this transform not just the South, but the entire working class? Or is this maybe a bit too far just yet? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1970. That was the first observation of Earth Day. Across the United States, millions of people took to the streets and parks to demonstrate for clean air, water, and a reduction in pollution and care for nature and the environment. The idea for Earth Day began with Democratic Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson. He was inspired to action when he witnessed the devastation caused by an oil spill in Santa Barbara, California. Senator Nelson knew for the day to be a success, he needed to reach across the aisle. He found an ally in Republican Congressman Pete McCloskey. He also found support from organized labor. The national coordinator for Earth Day was Dennis Hayes. Hayes explained, quote, "Without the UAW, the first Earth Day would have likely flopped. The UAW was by far the largest contributor to the first Earth Day, and its support went beyond the merely financial. It printed and mailed all of our material at its expense, even those critical of pollution-belching cars. 20 years later, Earth Day truly went global. In 1990, it was estimated that 200 million people from 141 countries participated in Earth Day action. President Bill Clinton awarded Senator Nelson the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest honor granted to a U.S. civilian for his role in Earth Day. The role of the United Auto Workers in the first Earth Day demonstrates the importance that labor can play in the environmental movement.
All things ain't what they used to be, now oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, it's interesting, Eric hit on something I think really important there. Because, you know, it is an election year. And I keep saying a lot of what you're seeing is because you have a friendly administration that's saying we're going to administer the National Labor Relations Act in the way that it was meant, and that is to give a little deference to workers and push for the idea of collective bargaining, that you deal with issues, with problems, with wages, hours, conditions, all of that stuff in the workplace. Look, I've always said that, you know, minimum wage laws are, yeah, those are great. It's good to push for them. But we shouldn't be fighting all of our battles at the bottom. We should be raising people up. And in those workplaces that are being paid minimum wage, those workers should be organizing to be able to sit down and collectively bargain and go, what is my labor really worth? Because ultimately, that's the question. You know, when you sit down and you negotiate, and I've done a little bit of this over the years where you go, these are the books. This is the wealth that the workforce creates. And you're talking about, how do we divide that pie up? Yeah, you got to feed the shareholders. Yeah, you got to feed the owners. You got to feed management. You got to feed all of those other folks, but you also got to feed your own children. And this is where this idea of pushing for collective bargaining, you know, kept labor peace, you know, of the 30s, you know, brought labor peace back. But also built the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization, because it gave workers the ability to sit down with management on something of an equal footing and say, this is what we demand. We demand a share of what we create. And it's interesting to hear the right go on about, well, you know, they want all of this stuff. No, they want what's available. And this is what the discussion about sitting in negotiating a contract is always interesting to me about. Because, you know, they're going to say, well, you know, they want too much. No, they want what's available. They want what they see in the books that their wealth creates. So when you go, the UAW is asking for, you know, $35 an hour for their workforce. You go, yeah, because the money's there. And I find it interesting because I'm watching this debate that's going on, this weird kind of argument over Caitlin Clark. And, you know, she's phenomenal. She's an incredible women's basketball player. Someone that I guarantee, you know, every parent of a high school or a young girl who wants to play basketball, you know, for my daughter, it was Breonna Stewart. For the next generation, it's going to be Caitlin Clark. They want to emulate her. But it's interesting watching people go, she's only getting $76,000. And while these basketball players in the NBA, they're getting millions. And you go, well, a big reason of that is, well, one, collective bargaining. Open up the books. Let's see what the money is. And also, oh, by the way, the money is there. And these workers are going, hey, we want some of that. We want some of the wealth that our labor creates. It's just, well, it's that simple for me. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast, always available for your audio listening. Also, miss any of the video, freespeech.org. That's where you go to check out the video. As always, I appreciate you being here. Thanks so much. We'll see you back here again.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.